the problems that you're going to be given are not those problems to which Methodism can be applied. The checklist isn't going to have all the answers for what you're trying to solve.
Greetings, and welcome to the Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of war.
I'm Major Josh Bedingfield, here alongside Majors Kelsey Kurtz and Dan Warner. We'll be your hosts today. Our guest today is the Director of the Advanced Strategic Leadership Studies Program, or ASLSP, at the School of Advanced Military Studies, Dr. Scott Gorman. Dr. Gorman is a retired U.S. Air Force colonel and career pilot whose last assignment before retiring from active duty was as Commandant and Dean, School of Advanced Air and Space Studies at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. He holds a Bachelor's of Science in Engineering from the U.S. Air Force Academy, a Master's in Russian History from Indiana University, an MMAS from the School of Advanced Military Studies, and a PhD in International Relations from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
Going after my heart there, sir, with your Master's in History, Russian History in particular, you'll find a keen spirit in me on that subject of study.
Fantastic. I appreciate that, Josh.
Yeah. So the topic today, I think, is probably one of Dan and Kelsey and I's favorite things, to find ourselves in deep cognitive holes while staring at a whiteboard in our studies, which is theory, the second of the two pillars in our small series now on the pillars of operational art, or how to build an operational artist. So we asked around, sir, you know, as theory covers many different disciplines, and the running question for a while was, who's the person we need to talk to about the theory of theory? And you came up on the line pretty quick. So,
well, if theory is really your favorite thing, then you three truly are Sam's nerds.
I'm not going to speak for Kelsey or Dan, but I'll talk for Dan. He's
yeah,
a bigger nerd than
I am right now.
No, not good. Kelsey.
I'm just here to keep Josh and Dan grounded. I think if I wasn't on board, it would be all Russian operational art theory and the theory of war game.
Good. Yeah, it's good that you're here.
The show would be called Why Svechnin and Tukhachevsky Should Hold a More Prominent Discussion Point in Army Primary Military Education, which is me talking about theory and not the names of Dan's turtles, because that is one of Dan's turtles is named Tukhachevsky. He's a rabble rouser.
Very nice. Yeah, very nice.
There would be an obvious Lord of the Rings metaphor in there too, Josh, somehow.
Yeah, sure. So theory, sir, it plays a really prominent role in the development of operational artists across all of SAM's curricula and the Advanced Military Studies program, ASP3, and the program that you run. I would argue carries the prominent majority of the time that we spend in these higher echelons of professional military education. We spend talking about theory. So you get the only pass of any guests we've had or are going to have. And we are not going to start with our token question of what is operational art with you.
I will take that pass. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. We're still gonna,
but we'll come back there, because I do want to talk about it.
Sure. We're excited. So you want to start, sir, on kind of talking about how you might define your definition of what a theory is, and then maybe how it might apply to operational art?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to start by, I have a much looser understanding, and I like the word understanding better than definition of theory. And we can talk about that for a little bit too. But my understanding of what theory is pretty simple. It's what we think about how the world works. So it's all about cause and effect, right? So it's what we need to do in a given context in order to achieve the effects that we're trying to achieve, how the world works.
So if you take that and we work it down, it's an understanding of how the world works. The world works in mysterious ways across many things, many different domains, right? You have, you know, you're professionally educated in both history and international relations, those being two that I would say a lot of theories find themselves operating within. I'd be interested to ask you kind of a hypothetical negative.
Sure,
on,
sure.
You know, what would trying to understand nuanced ways of the world, how the world works, work in the absence of theory? What do we have in the absence of theory?
Yeah, I think it's hard to imagine a world absent of theory, right? Because we all are human beings who want to know how things work. And we all have goals, objectives, outcomes that we're trying to achieve. So we necessarily think about what do we need to do in a given context in order to make things happen. So, you know, it's almost an impossible to say that we can imagine a world without theory. So given that, you know, I think the real question is, okay, well, how is military theory different, or how is the theory of operational art different? What, you know, how do we limit ourselves to that? I personally, again, back to this idea of definitions versus understanding, I'm not big on a one single definition of what operational art is or what military theory is. I think it's better to use theoretical pluralism. So many different ways of understanding something so that we can, you know, we come at things from many different directions. We understand it. We see it from many different perspectives. So, you know, same with operational art. You know, three definitions is better than two is better than one. We can understand exactly what it is or get a better understanding by having all those definitions.
Yeah, I think, I mean, amongst definitely us three, and you know, Dan and Kelsey, please don't let me take words or put words in your mouth. But you know, one of the token, you know, oral comps questions at the end of SAMS is, you know, what is your theory or definition of operational art? And I think that it speaks to the fact that when you takes, you know, we've got around 55 students in our class right now, and I don't think that any of us have the same understanding of what our internal theory of operational art is. We all share that doctrinal definition, but I learn a lot when I hear Dan talk about how he understands operational art, or Kelsey when she understands operational art. And the way you just put that three is better than two is better than one, I think is a good way to frame how a pluralistic view on something that someone else might want to define helps us understand it better, even if it convolutes the firm definition.
So maybe what's better to think about isn't necessarily what the exact definition is or what operational art is, but it's what we use it for. So the purpose of operational art, right? So if we see operational art as kind of a theoretical method, then there ought to be some effect or object that we're after by using operational art, right? So, you know, I'm very pragmatic about it, that it's, we don't study operational art. We don't, you know, read all the books that all of you are reading, just for edification, to think about it. We do it because we want to achieve some practical effect on the ground, right? You all are going to go out and be operational planners. And it's going to go beyond you just understanding a situation, beyond writing a plan. It's going to be all about achieving some effect, right? So the purpose of operational art, you know, let's use the classic definition, you know, arranging tactical actions in time, space, and purpose to achieve in whole or in part some strategic outcome or effect. And it is all about that. How do we achieve the effect, right? What happens when we do operational art? Doesn't matter how you do it, it's what happens when you do that thing, what you achieve.
Hey, sir, I got a follow up. I just want to highlight something I think is interesting in your background, and that's your bachelor's degree is in engineering from the Air Force Academy. And then you did a pretty hard switch into Russian history and international relations. How do you think that your engineering background kind of influences the way that you understand, dissect, and apply different theories?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a false flag there, because I was a history major at the Air Force Academy. So I'm a history major with a Bachelor of Science, right, an engineering degree. But I do think you're onto something. I do think that, you know, having that background may make me think in certain ways about the way we should go about theory, right? That it's empirical, it's scientific, that we ought to test it. So yeah, that probably does. There's some bias there given my educational background.
Man, I'll jump out a small little tiny Russian grenade here and say that somebody with an engineering degree or even a background in math, any mathematical discipline, would probably find a keen interest in Russian, at least Russian military history. given their general historical predilection for distilling complex military paradigms into what one could be, I think one could argue is like an engineered mathematical equation, far more so than, you know, European theorists would do, where it's much more qualitative in nature.
Like a strategic correlation of forces model, Josh?
Yeah, and I agree with you, Josh, that Russian military theory is very different than Western military theory, U.S. military theory. You know, if you put it in terms of Clausewitz, Russians are more about positive doctrines, right? Theories that are more scientific, that can be quantified, that are numerical, that actually, you know, can be followed. As opposed to Western theories are just ideas about how to get things done, right? That we put into practice, we try them out, we get them wrong, we circle back around, and we do it all over again. We change our theory, we apply it, and see what happens. That's very, very different approach to military theory than Russians.
So kind of on the topic about theory's relationship with history and doctrine, how do you think that those interact, influence one another? I know you've touched on it a little bit from an East versus West perspective, but just in looking holistically at the pillars of operational art.
Yeah, so if theory is all about getting things done, then we can't know whether our theories are useful unless we put them into practice, right? So we need some practical experience to be able to test our theories. Given that we have limited lifetimes and limited personal experiences, the other place to turn is historical experience, right? So we and again, recommended by Clausewitz, collect as many historical examples as you can to help you to understand that question of how things work. So we use history as kind of the proving ground, the theoretical proving ground. It is the practice that helps us to refine our theories. So history is, you know, whether you see it as, you know, the chicken that comes before the egg that, you know, helps to lay the egg, or it is the chicken that hatches from the egg, right? It's integrally related to theory.
Do you have a favorite historical period that you like to refer to look for these vignettes for practice as we kind of discuss, you know, MDO and integration of multiple effects across time, distance, location?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I have an affinity for Russian military history, but, you know, I don't limit myself to that. You know, I would just say to be careful, and again, back to this idea of theoretical pluralism, is that we ought to take in as much history from as many different situations, as many different periods as we can to understand the phenomena that we're trying to understand. So, you know, Clausewitz recommends that you do it as modern as possible, right? He says as close to the present, because the situation, the tactics, the techniques, the technologies will be closer to what you're trying to understand. But, you know, I don't think that's always true, because even in antiquity, there are situations that, you know, especially at the higher, the operational and the strategic levels, we can compare and contrast and find differences and similarities that help us to refine our theories at those levels. So I don't think I answered your question, Kelsey, but you know, the more history, the better.
You've definitely at least found a way to inadvertently support something that we did an episode with Dr. Nowitzki on history, and I know that you and Dr. Nowitzki go way back. And one of the things that he talked about was how it's better, you know, to read a chapter of a book than it is to buy five and read none of them. And what you just talked about how having kind of a wide range of experiences, I think that there's a link there where becoming at least, you know, functionally familiar with the different eras of military history through the eras of military revolution is a much smaller hill than some might find it to be, because you can always find something that tells you enough to contextualize the general trend, I think. And I'm just going to throw Dan under the bus and say that the fact that he didn't jump on the fact that you brought up antiquity as a viable...
I was waiting my turn.
There is no turn.
I'll jump in and talk over you here. But yeah, I appreciate you supporting my my underground effort of the operational level of war existing in antiquity. campaigns of Julius Caesar, or dare I say the Fabian tactics, was actual operational art. I guess that's a big controversy to say it happened before antiquity.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally agree with you, Dan. I think, you know, there are some who talk about the operational art, right? When we say the operational art, include the article, we're talking about, you know, a certain way of doing things in the modern era, right? But if we say operational art in a more general sense, then we're talking about this arranging tactical actions, time, space, and purpose to achieve strategic outcomes. And I don't think there's any war or any conflict that you can point to when, you know, great commanders weren't arranging tactical actions to achieve outcomes, right? So operational art probably has always existed, just in different forms.
And that actually leads in nicely to the importance of theory and maybe the difficulty of teaching theory, at least at SAMS, right, to a bunch of majors, been in 12 years, and you have this naturally pluralistic, dialectic thing, right, that is theory, and you're teaching it to a bunch of people that have fed doctrine. And yes, doctrine is descriptive, not prescriptive, but we like to have clear definitions, right? People like to go and go off of a known point of a definition, and theory, you know, really benefits from having those divergent points of debarkation, if you will, and then through dialectic, right, coming through to the answer. So with that, could you maybe go into more of like how you do that to a military mind, right? How do you help somebody think pluralistically or dialectically with theory?
Yeah, first I want to take that question about doctrine and how doctrine relates to theory, right? Understand that. You know, I think of doctrine as kind of the crystallization of our theories. So it is, you know, what we kind of all agree upon in a given context at a given time in terms of the way things work. So we you know, write it down, we teach it, we formalize it, we crystallize what we know about military things. But the problem with that is, as when we do that, the world is changing all around us, right? New technologies are developing, new political relationships, new political objectives, et cetera, et cetera. So that doctrine almost immediately is, I hate to say wrong, but it's outdated, and there are at least parts of it that no longer apply to the situation that we're going to find ourselves in. So, you know, we have to think of doctrine as a mutable, a changeable thing that is just good for any one moment in time. All right, so that's it. Say your question again, Dan.
It's really how theory is baked into the course, right? You have a theory foundations block, and then the strings of theory get pulled throughout the course. And I guess, is that in an effort to, if you didn't get it the first time, to get it potentially the second iteration, third iteration, right? Are these continual iterations in the program to make sure you walk away with an understanding of theory? Or is there maybe something like more behind of why you keep seeing theory as we pull these threads to these different sections?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of different reasons why we spend so much time studying theory at SAMS. I mean, first is just the fundamental importance of theory, right? To educate the mind of the commander, the operational planner, right? You have to have a basic understanding of how military things are done, what we agree upon as kind of the way to do things to achieve effects. The second is that, you know, I think many of you come to SAMS with the expectation that, hey, we're going to study military theory. So that means we're going to read, Little Hart, we're going to read Clausewitz, we're going to read Jomini. But theory is much more than that, because military operations are much more than that. You know, when you think of all the different things that we in the military affect, influence, touch, then there are a whole lot of different theories that we have to delve into, read, and understand. Right? So it's not just about military theory. We also have to teach, we ought to teach political theory, we ought to teach economic theory, we ought to teach, you know, psychology, anthropology. There are a whole bunch of different things that will make you more effective operational artists. So therefore, you know, we're going to spend time, a lot of time, not just on military theory, but other theories as well. So that explains why there's the weight of theory in the entire SAMS program.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say and offer that one of the most impactful things that I've taken away from this, my time at SAMS so far, was not a military theory. It was actually Taseem's theory, on anti-fragility, this concept of systems that are structured in such a way that when they are negatively affected, disrupted, disintegrated, destroyed, neutralized, they emerge on the far side of that crisis actually stronger. They absorb that adversity in such a way that the system itself evolves to be stronger on the far side of it, which he did not write for a military audience. I would argue that he wrote that for a social perspective on how, you know, human systems interact with one another.
Yeah, Josh, that's a great example of, you know, why we study different theories, right? Because Taleb's anti-fragility gets into complexity theory, it gets into systems theory, it gets into all those things that, you know, may not seem to be directly related to military operations, but, you know, the more you understand about the context of military operations, kind of the uncertainty, the interdependence, the all those things, the more it does apply in terms of, you know, what you do as an operational artist.
And it seems the Army, maybe even the military as a whole, you know, we always seem to go in these cycles of struggling to prove that we're a profession, right? We have a profession because of X, Y, and Z. And it really was here at SAMS going through this theory where, like, you see how the military profession has a piece of theory that derives from scientific theory, right? Like, you're maybe a subcomponent, your theory might be a subcomponent, has similarity with other theories, so you could tie things that somebody in economics, who you have nothing in common with, you have commonalities once you strip away the details. And I think that, amongst anything, if we want to show, you know, how the profession of arms fits into overall science and overall theory, I mean, that is the exemplar, I would think.
No, that's a great great point, Dan. And you know, you can also look, if military theory is kind of one subcomponent of larger bodies of theory, within military theory there are subcomponents too, right? So we can talk about air power theory, we can talk about land power theory, you know, so we could break it down by domains, however you think about it, that there are subcategories of military theory as well that kind of build into that larger thing.
Do you think it's correct to look at FM3-0 as the Army's current theory of victory, and that's something that we'll go on and test as we develop the Army for 2030? And then I guess caveat with that, maybe not a caveat, but I'm trying to get us to stop and move from course of action analysis, right? Course of actions, hypothesis, right? Hypothesis of action, right? It seems like the staff would lose a lot less pounds of flesh if we call it a hypothesis of action, because you're expecting it to mutate a little bit or change, right? We have this weird tension of we want to say, we believe, you know, no plan survives first contact. Sounds like a hypothesis, right? Can't be proven true, can't be proven false, or can be modified, right? So it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on that, if FM3-0 is a theory of victory.
That's a great way to think about theory is, you know, it's all about the question, right? We're asking questions of the world, we're coming up with hypothetical answers, and then we're testing to see if those answers are correct. All right, so that's that hypothesis that theory that we come up with that's crystallized in doctrine is our hypothesis about how we, the U.S. Army, are going to fight in the next conflict, right? So yes, I do think that's the role of FM3-0 is to kind of lay that out. Now, there's another kind of, if you remember from Young Men in Fire, when they're talking about the theory of the phenomenon, theory of fire, versus the theory of action, how do you as a firefighter then deal with that thing that you're trying to defeat, right? So it's you know, we at SAMS study the theory of the phenomenon that is war, right? So think of Clausewitz and the nature of war. But we also study theories of action. Okay, how do we apply ourselves to this larger phenomenon of war in a given situation in order to achieve what we want to achieve? Right, so FM3-0 is kind of a theory of action. It is, you know, you described it as a theory of victory. How do we apply the means and capabilities we have in order to do the things we want to do in the given context?
Yeah, first I have to correct myself. I said earlier the anti-fragile author, have to give due deference to him. His name is Nassim Taleb, not Tassim. So that's a small correction on my part. But working from what you and Dan were just talking about, you know, FM3-0 being a theory of victory, also full in on attaching myself to Dan's lead train that it's a hypothesis of action. How might we as we graduate, or a young planner's out there and they're on a staff and they've heard your words of wisdom and, you know, says to herself, I'm going to get short on theory. And then she walks into that next planning cycle, charged with building options to meet the current problem in front of her staff. We know that doctrine is going to be a part of that plan about how we frame it. We know if we accept this concept that history is important, that there's a historical anecdote that we're going to draw on to inform a broader understanding of the problem and systems at play. How would you encourage her, though, to sitting on that OPT in front of other people who might not have any inkling or predilection towards acknowledging the value of theory, to say, I'm talking about weak and sense making right now. We need to understand this theory and apply it, or, you know, drop your tools. Young Men in Fire told me to drop, we need to drop our tools right now, or Nave's operational shock, or, you know, insert whatever theory here. How do we operationalize it? How does somebody who's theoretically minded walk into a planning staff and say, this is how I'm going to integrate this into our process to generate a better outcome on the far side?
Yeah, I mean, you get at a good point, Josh. The whole idea of you don't want to be the Sam's nerd that walks into the OPT, right? You want to, you know, have influence and effect. You want to be able to get your points across. So yeah, you're not going to use the language that we may use in the classroom at Sam's. Your OPT is probably not read, Schoen's Reflective Practitioner, or name any other reading in Sam's. They haven't read it. So part of your job is to be a teacher too, right? So you've got to, in very direct ways, explain, help them to understand what it is you're talking about. So again, back to just simple, straightforward, you know, theory is the art of what works. It is figuring out in a given context what works. And how do you get at that? How do you communicate that to other people who may very well know more than you do about practical application, right? About the practice. Okay. So taking your theoretical framework and applying it to their expertise in the practice.
Is there not to use an analogy of your experience with a historical vignette, but do you have any best practices you found in terms of doing just what Josh asked about operationalizing different theories within an OPT? What worked for you? Maybe what you've seen hasn't worked as well.
Yeah, probably the most important thing when you're trying to do that, back to this idea of theoretical pluralism, right? And that's the value of having a diverse OPT. And by diversity, I don't necessarily mean, you know, one of each type or all different types. What I'm talking about is different ways of thinking. So people who come from different backgrounds, who have different degrees, who have different areas of expertise, who have seen different things throughout their careers, and bringing them into a room and letting them openly discuss, right? Because that's how you get that theoretical pluralism, those different ideas about the way that whatever it is you're facing is going to be resolved, or how you're going to achieve effects in the situation that you're in. So diversity is the biggest thing. So I don't know if that's a practical example, but that's just a kind of a rule number one for you as an OPT lead.
Yeah, thinking about the idea of, you know, for the record, I'm not going to walk into a room and say, you know, weak told me to sense make, because then the first question is who's weak, and I make perfect sense. But I think what's difficult about it is when seeking a pluralistic perspective, but you're coming from a position of, let's call it either, you know, positional or, you know, a power, right? You walk in and you say, here's my idea, or here's an idea, and you try and generate that pluralism. Perhaps the biggest challenge in front of that attempt would be to actually get your team to understand that just because you introduced it, that's just the door. You're just showing the doorway, and you want to invite people in where there's going to be head bashing and some gnashing of teeth. Somebody's going to run out of ink on the whiteboard because they're furiously writing so much. But just you being the one introducing it might inhibit that a little bit.
Yeah, there was a reason why the King of Prussia was always supposed to go last in Kriegspiel, and why Kriegspiel fell apart when he started going first. it's hard to be that leader, right? And going first and saying something and have people say the opposite of what you said.
It all depends on how you lead, though, too, right? If you are a leader who is open to other opinions, to diverse inputs and criticism and correction, I mean, yeah, as opposed to the leader who stands up and dictates the way things are going to be done and what the answer is. Those are very different ways of leading. Now, that said, sometimes, you know, because there's going to be so much diversity in an OPT, in a group, that it's going to require somebody to stand up and take charge. You know, ultimately, if you are the OPT lead, you are in charge. You're the one responsible for getting things done. So sometimes you're going to have to stand up and say, okay, this is the way we're going to do it. Let me tell you about how this works and why, you know, probably the more important question, why we're doing it this way, why this is going to help us to get to the end that we're trying to achieve. And I see, Josh, that you're given the wrinkled forehead look. You know, those seem to be two paradoxical statements, right? Hey, be open and diverse and accepting of all opinions, but be willing to stand up and tell people how to get things done, right? They're not. It's all situational, and you and your judgment have to figure out when best to apply those rules.
Yeah, I'm going to unfortunately have to respond to that with my standard defense that I've had to offer to a few general grade officers this year, that is just my face. And it's just what my face does when I'm thinking. I'm trying to find out ways to contain it. So,
he's been called out plenty of times for this.
It's like more than I'm comfortable with. Like I typically field like one or two of those on a calendar year, and it's about every month so far. So it's a bad habit I developed during COVID where nobody could see my lower face, and my inherent frown when I'm thinking, but I'm going to continue musing on it a little bit. And cede the floor to Dan or Kelsey to have something to say while I think I'm pondering.
So in an OPT or leading a group, how do you think that we can determine which theories are or are not relevant to the problems in front of us?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's probably the question, right? So it's, you know, if theory and whether or not it applies all depends on the context, and you got to figure out the context. So the first thing you ought to do, you know, again, back to Clausewitz, and I hate to keep referring back to Clausewitz because now I'm showing myself as a Sam's nerd, but you have to determine what type of war it is that you're in, right? You got to figure out what the situation is. What is the context? And what's, you know, one thing we tend to miss is we always look for similarities. We look for analogs, right? Situations that are similar. But really what we ought to be looking for are the things that are different, because it's the differences that are going to have the greatest effect. You know, going to really influence whether the theory that we're trying to apply is applicable or not. So not just similarities, but make sure you're thinking about differences. How does the situation that I'm in right now differ from that historical example that I just pulled up and referred to? You know, what's different? How is that going to change how I approach it given that difference?
So we talk a lot about cultural empathy, and when we're looking at different systems and the theories that are fit to describe them or not to describe them, and trending towards the similarity of what we know, right? So kind of overlaying our American-centric, English-centric theories and systems onto what's going on in the world around us. You know, you've studied a lot of Russian history and international relations. How do you encourage your students to better develop that cultural context and cultural sympathy?
Yeah, that's a great point. This idea of cultural empathy, right? That we, in order to take effective action, we have to understand the opponent as well, or even our collaborators or the people that are working beside us who think differently than we do. We have to understand how they think as well. Now, how best to do that? You know, that's the whole purpose of all of you going through Great Power Perspectives, where we do kind of an in-depth dive into the culture, the history, the military thought, all those things, get a better understanding of the way those both adversary and, you know, ally think differently than we do. Again, emphasizing the difference. How best to do that? Yeah, I again, you ought to take in a broad array. It's not just, you know, if I'm going to learn about kind of the Russian way of thinking, I wouldn't just study Russian military history. I'd look at Russian culture. I'd look at religion. I'd study the language. All of those things help me to better understand their perspective.
Sir, I guess this comes from like bringing up Russians and thinking about Russian theory and thinking about what we lack potentially in our theory. It's my opinion, right, just me coming out of left field, right, that we lack the qualitative, how about the desire to do any type of qualitative analysis into our theories, right? Like, as an intel officer by trade, one of my biggest pet peeves is, like, we are very good at telling you how many T-90s are in that battalion. When we go to do COA analysis wargaming, I have no way to make that mean something to the commander, right? I have COFAMs that, unless I was a nerd like I am, I don't understand and I don't know how to build, right? And they're outdated. So do you think we could benefit maybe from looking at how Russians do theory and providing some mathematical rigor behind it? Granted, you know, I don't think the extremes of, like, the Soviets back in the day having strategic COFAMs and, like, how deterministic it potentially was, but at least this idea of, like, when we say combat power has five elements, here is a way to quantify these elements so it's useful. It's a useful model in, like, wargaming.
Yeah, so Dan, there is both an art and a science to operational art, right? To warfighting. There's both art and science, and we have to know the science. So that's where the numbers and the COFAMs and the formulas all apply. So yes, there is utility in that. But it shouldn't be at the expense of that other side, the art, right? The more general understanding. So this gets back to this idea of positive doctrines, where we come up with essentially one play that we know works, and we run that play over and over again, right? A positive doctrine. This is the way to do it. But that doesn't reflect the real context in which we're in that's constantly changing. So we have to somehow have judgment to see those changes and then to know how to change our script to match those changes, right? To do something different when it's needed. And that's even more true. You know, quantitative, numerical, positive doctrines are probably better at the tactical, technological levels, right? Where the science really applies. But at the higher levels, where wars are really won, at the high operational and strategic levels, because that is ultimately what really matters, that's where we win wars, those things are less important, and that judgment is more important. And so that ought to be the key, the most important role of theory is to inform that judgment that's required at those higher levels.
Yeah, I think it also, to what Dan said, and building on this concept of plurality, though, is that there's a thread within it where oftentimes when we find the understanding, it's in light of nine theories that are unique unto themselves when viewed through a rangefinder, but when collated, build something entirely new, right? Even in that positive doctrine sense, you know, I'm going to talk tactics for a second, but, you know, Battle Drill 1 Alpha says, you know, when the squad takes contact, you establish a base of fire, squad leader comes up, assesses the situation, determines if you're going to break contact or do a bold left or right flank. But oftentimes when you're in that moment, the theory of will comes into a factor where maybe there isn't a bold right or left flank and you just need to move forward and get inside of that machine gunner's decision cycle, which sounds weird because what you're talking about is a bum rush. But when you peel back kind of those micro decisions and then you can extrapolate that to big time, there's theory at play there, right? Where it's easy for me to attain a target with a weapon system when I only have one target in front of me. But when I have four targets in front of me, your relative likelihood of succeeding in any of your hits actually goes down. And this makes sense when we say that these things out loud, but it comes at odds with the ideas of positive doctrine. I have found in my limited experience in the tactical realm, you know, I'm still a recovering infantry officer at heart, though.
So a couple of ideas there, Josh. The first is this idea of, you know, there are some situations that are fairly linear, fairly direct, maybe more likely at the tactical level where, you know, this procedural methodism, right, where we have a method, we've got a checklist, and we know if we just apply this checklist, we're probably going to do pretty well, right? And that works just fine. But there are other situations, and this is more true for all of you who are field grade officers and above, the problems that you're going to be given are not those problems to which methodism can be applied. The checklist isn't going to have all the answers for what you're trying to solve. So you've got to do something different. In a lot of cases, you know, our deductive logic may not work. So we may not have a theory of how to do things, a larger theory that explains all of the world. And inductive logic may not work because we don't know the details of the situation. We just, there's so much uncertainty out there that we just, you know, we can't know where to go and what to do. So we may use abductive logic, which is what you're describing. Hey, let's just do something. Let's test the system, see how the system reacts, and then we'll go from there. And then maybe we can revert to a known theory, a known deductive theory where, you know, we can apply it to our situation. Or it can help us to build a little bit of intelligence and data from which we can, you know, use inductive logic and build a course of action.
So, you know, the Marine Corps here has gotten like a very soft core shout out, where I first and foremost described the value of frontal assault. And then you talked about the value of like learning in action, which they're doing, taking great strides and building into their doctrine as a methodology when faced with a complex problem where the prescriptive or positive doctrine doesn't find its way into an outcome that seems favorable.
And that may be a reflection of the Marine Corps' love of John Boyd and the OODA loop, right? And that essentially is what we're describing is the OODA loop.
I was really wondering how far into this episode we would get without mentioning Boyd. So what's our time now?
Yeah, I guess we finally got there. Huh?
43 minutes. And, you know, for anybody out there, I'll say that anybody who wants like a really great take on Boyd, that's going to, I think, eventually have to be an episode unto itself. Jim Greer at Operational Alchemist on Twitter, the man who continues to be mentioned on all of these episodes, is running a really great thread right now on how to think about Boyd's OODA loop and the practical application for the modern operational environment we find ourselves in now. So short, small plug there on if you want to go into Boyd, there's an open door available for you to walk right through. No, I think that's actually a good spot to kind of close out. I mean, the final question that we've eventually led ourselves to, just because Clausewitz, by my account, got mentioned about 9 times, you know, strictly hypothetically or theoretically speaking, you know, in a cognitive battle of the theory, you know, alongside of the battle, who's gonna win? Is it Clausewitz or Isserson? Like, who's coming out on top right now? Who's given us the edge?
Yeah, I always revert back to Clausewitz, so it's kind of an unfair fight. So I don't know that there's any comparison. I thought you were going to go the easy route and say Clausewitz versus Jomini, and then it was a no contest. But Isserson draws on Clausewitz, so you know it's hard to say which is better. He may be an evolution, a better version of Clausewitz. So I don't know. Yeah, in terms of Jomini, you can just imagine from my emphasis on this idea of positive doctrine and how that kind of sets us back, why I wouldn't be a Jomini fan.
Yeah, well, sir, I'll give you an opportunity to close out. You know, we're really appreciative of your time. It's been a really great conversation. I'm still chewing on your muse. I'll shoot you an email afterwards on my thoughts on it. Do you have any closing words for us or the audience, or just some things to chew on? And I'm going to add to that for our audience out there who might consider themselves interested in getting into theory, maybe like one or two book recommendations on where you think they should start.
Yeah. Well, first, thanks for inviting me. I had fun just thinking about theory again and talking to you about it. So thanks. I appreciate that. In terms of where to start, yeah, if you haven't read Clausewitz, I'd definitely go there. Even if it's just, you know, the most popular sections, you know, the very front of the book where he talks about the nature of war and the theory of war, or later in the book when he talks about use of historical examples, critical analysis, all of those are a good starting point if you want to think about theory and the importance of theory. So that'd be my first place. And yeah, I'll go with Dr. Greer and say OODA loop's not bad either. John Boyd's presentations and Osinga's kind of interpretation of Boyd is another good place to go. If you're just looking for a fun read, really good writing, McLean, Norman McLean, and Young Men in Fire is a great place to start in terms of theorizing, and like we talked about, theories of phenomena and then theory of action. But there's a lot of good stuff on the the Sam's book list. If you just pick and choose some things off of that, that's never a good, never a bad place to go. Final words, I would just say, if there are aspiring young operational artists out there that think they might be up for Sam's, you know, I encourage them to apply in the next cycle, and don't rule yourself out by not applying. Give it a shot, and see if you got what it takes, and come to Sam's and enjoy your year studying operational art and preparing to go out and do great things.
Yeah, thanks so much for that, sir. Fully concur. I think that we're really looking forward to kind of getting some of our peers together for an episode on kind of what we thought we'd get out of it versus what we now know we have gotten out of it.
Yeah, good.
The opportunity is really, really great. It's hard to explain how you're going to individually change and learn over the course of the curriculum.
Yeah, it is, to be honest, it's a tough year, but it is also a rewarding year as all three of you are finding out, hopefully.
It's only really tough if you put off your monograph, which I definitely haven't done. So,
yeah, I wouldn't recommend that, Josh.
No, I'm definitely not there. But thanks for your time, sir. We really appreciate it. Look forward to running into you in the hallways. And that'll do it.
All right. Thank you again.
This has been an official publication of the School of Advanced Military Studies. The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS and the Operational Arch by following us on Twitter at US_SAMS. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode, send any proposals to operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.